Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, July 28th, and a lot of news going on this morning. President Trump is currently, as we speak, meeting with the UK Prime Minister in Scotland. This comes, of course, on the heels of the US and the EU announcing a new trade deal, and President Trump doing a lot dealing with U.S. global conflicts through Secretary of State Marco Rubio as well. The press secretary posted this morning that President Trump deserves a Nobel Peace Prize for everything that is going on. But let's turn to the HHS, because this you may not have heard. The HHS under Secretary Kennedy's leadership posted this press release last week. Under Secretary Kennedy's leadership, HHS is restoring integrity and transparency to organ procurement and transplant policy by putting patients' lives first. These reforms are essential to restoring trust, ensuring informed consent, and protecting the rights and dignity of prospective donors and their families. And meanwhile, RFK Jr. also is telling the National Governors Association last week that the NIH is researching if vaccines are causing the quote-unquote explosion of allergies in our children. So a lot going on in HHS. Let's welcome in our good friend, Raw Egg Nationalist. Charles Cornish Dale is his name, but he goes by Raw Egg Nationalist. And you can read his book, The Eggs Benedict Option, and all of the great articles that he publishes in the National Pulse and elsewhere. And so, Raw Egg, this is a conversation that, you know, you and I have had a lot in terms of Secretary Kennedy's leadership at HHS. And this press release, we'll turn to this first, about transparency to the organ procurement and transplant policy. This was really scary, quite frankly. And for a lot of people responding to this, at least on X and social media and elsewhere, even this didn't get a ton of national news, which I kind of find shocking. A lot of people are saying, you know, this validated basically what's been termed a conspiracy theory for a while, that that essentially organs are being harvested from patients who are not clinically dead, or who are still, there's still a chance of viability in terms of keeping them alive. Whether or not, you know, actually coming out of a coma is a whole different question. But this is a really serious ethical question. So good morning.
Good morning, Jenny. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about archetypal horror here. You know, I can remember when I was 10 years old reading a short story by Stephen King about a man who ends up on an autopsy table and he's not actually dead. And he's trying to alert the mortician, you know, that he's actually still alive. And he ends up managing, I think, to wiggle his toe. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this kind of thing for quite some time, actually. And although it's, you know, been termed a conspiracy theory, it's another conspiracy theory. You know, there's been reporting. NPR, for example, reported in October of 2024 the case of a man who was about to have his organs removed, and the nurses and the doctor attending were very, very unhappy because there was very clearly a sign that he was still alive. He was thrashing around on the table, actually. And the story goes on to say that actually the supervisor at the hospital said, well, okay, if these people won't do it, let's get some other people to do it. Let's get another doctor and some other nurses in, people who don't have any qualms about this, you know, thrashing body, and we'll get the organs that way. But now, it's really, you know, with this press release, then it's becoming a national issue, and it's being given, I think, or a kind of authority, I think, and people are actually kind of waking up to the scale of the problem. I mean, in the press release from Kennedy, you know, he talks, the press release talks about 351 cases where organ donation was authorized but didn't take place. So this was just a sample that they looked at. In 29%, there were concerning features, so clear neurological signs that were incompatible with donation. At least 28 patients may not actually have been deceased at the time donation was initiated. And the report goes on to identify various different factors involved in these, you know, potentially very, very serious, very, very unpleasant mistakes. Poor assessment, lack of coordination, questionable consent, and a misclassification of cause of death. And the, you know, the actual press release itself is headed systematic disregard for sanctity of life. And really, really, that is what it is. But why is this taking place? Well, it's taking place, I think, in large part because the system of organ donation in the US has changed considerably within the last 5 years or more. So there was actually a New York Times piece that was very good on the 20th of July this year that was headlined, "A Push for More Organ Transplants is Putting Donors at Risk." And basically it outlines these changes that have taken place in the organ donation system over the last 5 years. So more and more organs now are being donated, not by people who have been classified as brain dead, which is a state where basically, you know, the brain is dead, but the body is still being kept alive by machines so that organs can be removed. More and more donators are being subjected to what's known as donation after circulatory death, which is basically just when a doctor decides, well, that person isn't going to make it. It's a judgment call. They're not brain dead, but 20,000 organs a year now are harvested from people who have been subject to these sort of, you know, judgment calls, donation after circulatory death. And actually, it's a subjective thing. And what it appears, and what appears to be happening as well, which is dangerous, I think, is that you have these organ procurement organizations, which are nonprofits that operate in each state and are responsible for coordinating transplants. And what's happening is they're becoming very, very aggressive about securing organ donations. They're non-profits, so they're not doing it for money, but they have a mission, they have a job, and they have targets to meet, and, you know, they want to harvest as many organs as possible for donors. And so they're putting a lot of pressure on doctors and on families to undergo donation procedures when actually, you know, the person who's donating their organs may not be dead.
This is absolutely terrifying, and it is a sanctity of life issue because it is not for ethically and of course biblically, it is not for doctors to make a judgment call of who deserves life more, the current patient that they want to harvest the organ from versus the potential person that the organ would go to. And so there is this, as the HHS put it, a systematic disregard for the sanctity of life. And so you mentioned, Raw Egg, my special guest this morning, that the organ donation and the transplant system has changed in the U.S. How is this different, perhaps, than, say, where you are in the UK in terms of why this may be going on in the United States? Or does it potentially go on globally? We're just currently the only department right now of government that's actually looking into it.
I think this probably goes on globally. I'm not too familiar with the organ donation system in the UK. I do know that I've specified that I don't want to be part of it if I die. I'm not sure whether, I'm sure that there are the same pressures. I mean, basically what you have to understand, I think, with organ donation is when you take an organ from somebody, from a person, you want it to be as fresh as possible. Ideally, you actually want to take an organ from a body that is still in some minimal sense living. Because as soon as a person dies, then cell death occurs and the body starts to decay. And so, you know, the longer that process goes on, the less viable an organ is. So ideally, you want to take an organ from a body that is, let's say, brain dead. It's being kept alive. The blood is still circulating, but there's no critical function, whatever. So I think that this is just a problem that affects the organ donation industry as a whole, or the organ donation practice as a whole. And certainly I think if money comes into play, if people are paying for organ donation, if there's profit involved, then that makes it even more dangerous. But at least in the case with the practice that Secretary Kennedy is talking about, then it's non-profits who are certainly contributing to the problem, simply because they want to maximize the number of organs that can be harvested. I think it's a tricky business overall, but I think there has to be some kind of unequivocal assertion of maybe, you know, like the sanctity of a donor's life, and you know, like you can't pressure people, you can't pressure the families to it has to be their decision and their decision alone.
And all of that absolutely makes sense, and in practice should be what's going on. And so with this threatened closure of a deficient organ procurement organization, this program or this network, what is HHS planning to implement in terms of maybe a policy or a process that could hopefully at least begin to cure this?
I'm not actually sure at the moment actually what Secretary Kennedy has planned, but I do know that he's doing a great service simply by drawing awareness to this. And you know, you said at the beginning of the segment that actually not enough people have been paying attention to this, and hopefully more people will, because I think, like you said, this has existed in the realms of a conspiracy theory for so long. Oh, it's the, you know, it's Alex Jones stuff. This is nonsense. Nobody's having their organs harvested while they're alive. Well, actually, they are. And I think the first stage, obviously, is to generate some awareness of it.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the stuff, as you mentioned, of, you know, basically horror novels. And you would hope that this isn't actually going on in real life, but because the investigation has revealed, and this examination has revealed, as you said, 351 cases where organ donation was authorized but ultimately not completed, and at least 28 patients may have not been actually deceased at the time the organ procurement was initiated. According to this press release, raises serious ethical and legal questions. And Secretary Kennedy said, our findings show that hospitals allowed the organ procurement process to begin where patients showed signs of life, and this is horrifying. The entire system must be fixed to ensure that every potential donor's life is treated with the sanctity it deserves. And so while this is going on, I think this raises the question of whether or not an individual, because, you know, everybody knows when you go down to the DMV and you get your driver's license, they ask you at that point, do you want, you know, the little heart on your driver's license to, or at least that's how it was in Colorado, how it is now in my home state of Florida. Do you want to be an organ donor? And I think this may cause a lot of people to second guess that question. And so is that going to change in a negative way, potentially, the availability of the program that will actually save lives in the instance of a genuine death?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to expect that it would. This is horrifying. This is everybody's worst nightmare. It's on a par with being buried alive, or, you know, dying by some other horrible means. I mean, nobody wants to have their organs harvested while they're still alive. And so, yes, I mean, I think it will probably make a lot of people very wary about the organ donation system. I mean, I think awareness obviously has to be raised, because they're clearly, you know, abuses are clearly taking place. But I think it will be a tall order actually to restore faith in the system. Then, I mean, there will have to be incredibly strong safeguards, and people will have to be persuaded back to you know, considering actually donating their organs when they die.
Yeah, and as the HHS press release says, these reforms are essential to restoring trust, ensuring informed consent, and protecting the rights and dignity of prospective donors and their families. So if you want to read this press release, it was released on July 21st, and it's at hhs.gov, and also on the HHS Gov X account, and you can go read that. And the bottom line here is that you need to be making informed decisions for yourself and for your family in this and every area. So Raw Egg Nationalist, really appreciate your commentary on this. You can follow him on X. We'll be right back with more.
Together, you and I have much to celebrate. Last year, because of your caring help, Preborn rescued over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, I'm Dan Steiner, president of Preborn, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 little babies are taking their first breath now because of your caring help. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to one woman as she was deciding about the future of her baby. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet baby's heartbeat, the chance of that child living doubled. And Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Jesus Christ. Last year, we saw 8,900 women receive Christ as Savior. Your help is crucial to continue our life-saving work.
Your caring, tax-deductible gift saves lives. To learn more or donate, visit preborn.com/AFR or dial #250 and say the keyword baby.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it's been a minute since we have had an update on all things Israel from All Israel News and our good friend Joel Rosenberg and the Rosenberg Report. And last week, he had an opportunity to air an exclusive interview with Speaker Mike Johnson. And Mike Johnson said to All Israel News, quote, "I take it literally when the Bible commands nations to bless Israel and Jews as God's chosen people." And so Joel Rosenberg writes in the article accompanying this interview that Mike Johnson is not only a congressman, but he's also a conservative, a Republican, and a devout evangelical Christian. Raised in a strong Christian home, he was baptized when he was just 7 years old. And he's a man who loves the Bible and believes it is the very word of God. That, he told Joel, is why he loves Israel and the Jewish people so deeply, and why he is determined to do everything in his power to strengthen and deepen the U.S.-Israel alliance, despite an explosion of anti-Semitism and increasingly shrill attacks against the Jewish state from both the left and the right. So for more on this, Joel Rosenberg joins me now. And Joel, what a great opportunity to talk to Speaker Johnson in Washington, D.C., in his office. And, you know, I have a great photo at All Israel News of you shaking his hand, you know, right there in his speaker's office. So tell us more about this interview and Speaker Johnson's perspective.
Hey, Jenna, it's great to be with you. I'm happy to have that conversation. I do want to give you a shout out, a hello from the Front Range. I'm in Denver, Colorado with my wife. We've been having some board meetings here for our other ministry, the Joshua Fund. And it's just been so beautiful. My parents are out here as well. So anyway, yeah, I know this is home country for you. So
amazing. Well, say hello to Denver for me. Yes.
I will do that. Yeah, it was a great opportunity to spend time with the House Speaker, Mike Johnson. I had actually never met him. All my years in Washington, I lived here for 24 years, my wife and I raising our four sons. But when we moved to Israel 11 years ago, I'm back and forth meeting with and interviewing various leaders. But I just had not met yet House Speaker Mike Johnson. Totally intrigued with him. Like, he's a true Southern gentleman, like from Louisiana, strong believer, gentle, like, but strong. That to me, that's very interesting because he, you know, part of the conversation was he was very clear that he believes President Trump is absolutely right in the policies of standing with Israel and bombing the Iranian nuclear program out of existence. And Johnson took a very strong stand in sharp contrast to Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon and others who were blasting Trump for bombing the Iranian sites, saying that this was going to lead to more forever wars, that Israel and the Jews were dragging Trump to betray the MAGA base and to drag us into forever wars. And as Speaker Johnson told me, he said, this thing took 37 hours to bomb the Iran nuclear sites out of existence. He said, because Israel is a model ally, like Israel did the 97% of the work, and then the United States came with a plane, a B-2 stealth bomber, and a bomb, the bunker buster bomb, that nobody else in the world has. And what a great alliance when you can end a nuclear threat, not just to Israel and to our Arab allies in the Middle East, but to the United States and our interests and our allies and our America first approach. That is what a partnership should look like. And he was so, but he's a gentleman. He didn't give me sharp quotes like, "Oh, Tucker's, you know, crazy and he's, you know, kooky Tucker Carlson."
So he didn't trump the interview, basically.
No, and I think that makes them a good team, right? You know, Trump has his way of both leading and speaking. And it's not everybody's way, but it catches your attention. It draws people to pay attention to what the president is saying. But the most important thing is what the president does. The president told the world that he would never allow Iran to get the bomb. He told Iranian leaders, "You've got 60 days to negotiate with me, and I'll be happy to make a good deal with you, but you can't have the bomb." And on day 61, when they wouldn't make the deal, Trump gave Netanyahu the green light. And on day 11, when Netanyahu had gotten 97% of the job done, Trump finished the job, and the war was over in 12 days, not a forever war. So I thought that was just one example of but there's a huge war going on, as you know, Jenna, inside the Republican Party, and more importantly, well, more broadly in the Democratic Party, about cutting Israel loose. That's what Tucker Carlson is suggesting. He's telling President Trump, drop Israel. And Trump's like, absolutely not. This is the best. Not only is Israel the best ally America has, it's the exact type of ally America wants, where they do the fighting and America doesn't have to do most of the fighting, where Israel is willing to pay way more than its own fair share for its own defense, and so forth and so forth. So that's just one example. But I am troubled that over the past 18 months or so, there are a lot of shrill but influential voices on the American right, Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, chief among them, that are really hostile to Israel. I think that's a problem. But Speaker Johnson is a huge force with Trump and bringing the House Republicans to in real unity to stand with Israel and not let that sort of Tucker, Steve Bannon sentiment take root, at least in the House conference.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Joel Rosenberg, who's the editor-in-chief of All Israel News. You can find that at allisrael.com. And, you know, you mentioned that there's this ongoing faction among especially the right between the Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannons of the world and the Ted Cruz's and Mike Johnson's of the world. And thankfully, right now, President Trump is siding with Israel, and from a biblical worldview perspective, we would support that, of course. And do you think that in your interview with Speaker Johnson and his responses to why he supports Israel, not as just a matter of policy and a matter of being an ally, like, you know, kind of where President Trump leans for the most part, but also as a matter of his personal faith, did he have better responses than Ted Cruz in the now infamous Tucker Carlson interview? Or what did you make of that?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned Senator Ted Cruz, because I really appreciate that he was willing to go into the lion's den, as it were, and try to challenge Tucker on a lot of these wrong-headed and deeply problematic views that Tucker has. But yes, I think that in my view, Speaker Johnson did. I don't want to compare the two in terms of how well grounded they are in the scriptures. But Speaker Johnson gave a very robust explanation of how his faith in Jesus Christ, as well as his love for the Bible from Genesis all the way through the end of the Bible, informs why he loves Israel and the Jewish people. He seemed well versed in that. It didn't take much prodding or probing for him to go there. He went there first, and I asked some follow-up questions. But he made both cases. He made the faith-based case in which he talked about Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, what's known as the Abrahamic covenant, where God said, "I'm going to choose you, Abraham, And through your line, I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make you a people. You're going to be the leader of a great people. I'm going to give you a land, the land of Israel. And I'm going to use you to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. And that, of course, is the famous blessing through which the Messiah comes, through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. But God also said to Abraham, and those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. And Johnson was very clear, whereas Ted Cruz kind of forgot exactly where that was and exactly how to quote it. But, you know, I still appreciate Ted Cruz's belief in that. But Johnson was clearly, better grounded in a sense that he could quote the verse, he could talk about the principle, because he even said, look, there's different theological interpretations of that, but he said, I take it literally. I mean, I literally believe God's saying, I'm going to bless people and nations that bless Israel. That doesn't mean you have to agree with every single thing that Israel does. The point is, are you standing with a people that the some in the world, like the Iranian regime, are trying to annihilate, obliterate, liquidate, or are you, constantly attacking them, constantly undermining, saying you're going to cut them loose? And God is looking. God is watching. And so Johnson made that case based on faith, based on the Bible. But he also made the geopolitical case, which is, this is a great ally in Israel. Like, what else are we looking for? What is Tucker looking for in an ally? Oh, that was the point I made, but he affirmed it, which is, what is Tucker looking for in an ally? Does Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon, do they mean America alone, or do they mean America first? America first implies, and Trump says it outright, that we have allies. They just pay their fair share. They do the work. They're not a welfare basket case where America does all the money, America does all the fighting, America does all the, all the hard work, and the rest of the world coasts. That's feeling a little bit like France, right? Or some countries in Europe, as opposed to Israel, which is, is doing the work and making peace. So I really appreciated Speaker Johnson's perspective. I also thanked him for that, but I also thanked him, Jenna, for being so pro-life and for obliterating not just the Iran nuclear program with President Trump, but also funding for Planned Parenthood. And the House wanted 10 years. The Senate only did 1 year. But okay, that is a huge victory. And Speaker Johnson shared his own story with me, which I did not know. To my regret, I didn't know it. But he shared openly that his own birth was from two high school kids who were in love with each other but got pregnant out of wedlock, and they kept him. I mean, he's the baby that was born in 1972, just a year before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal. But it was still available even before. And so he talked about how that has influenced his heart for the pro-life cause and how he's worked so faithfully for the pro-life cause, because he himself could have been aborted. But he has a great family. His parents, by the way, did get married. They're married today. They raise him to be a strong Christian. So they made a mistake, but they corrected it. And here he is. I mean, I just found him a fascinating person that I think most Americans still don't really know, right? Everybody knows his name, or most people know, but I think, the president and the vice president, they take up a lot of political oxygen, so not everybody really knows the story or the values of the heart of Speaker Johnson. And I found that interesting both for All Israel News, as you mentioned, as well as the full interview on the Rosenberg Report, which airs on TBN.
Yeah, and I love that you are giving more history and color to who Speaker Johnson is. And as listeners know, I mean, I've known him personally for years because I had the opportunity to meet him initially when I started working for President Trump. And of course, nobody then was looking at him as a potential next speaker. And so I think when he kind of rose to that role, A lot of people are saying, well, wait a minute, we don't really know anything about him. And he's on record. People can go and listen to, you know, his podcast that he was doing with his wife, Kelly, to interviews that he's done with me, Abraham Hamilton III. We've all kind of known him as this very sincere, grounded man of faith. And so that does inform his decisions in all of these critical areas for pro-life policy. And obviously, as you know, Joel Rosenberg, that, you know, he's not the leader of the House in terms of just being able to dictate how the votes go. Otherwise, I think he would pass even more robust legislation. And that, unfortunately, in this situation is a good thing, right? I mean, we would love to see somebody like him and everybody share those same votes. But this is where, you know, it really matters to not just look at the actions, but look at kind of the man behind the scenes. But the last question for you, and I think people should go and listen to this full interview at the Rosenberg Report. When we say things like, you know, it's a matter of faith to us, obviously, and the speaker, to believe that God's covenant and his promise in Genesis 12 is not only literal, but it's continual. And so the nation of Israel and the Jewish people have a right to the land, and we defend that. There is a faith-based argument, but I love that he also took it to a matter of policy, because I think where Tucker and some of these others go with this is say, well, this is just a matter of faith to you, so you don't have another policy argument, almost like they do what the left does with pro-life arguments, right? Like, well, you're just saying that you're pro-life because you're a Christian, and if I don't believe in that same faith, well, then I don't have to buy your policy argument. And I think we need to be better as conservatives and as Christians in articulating not just our biblical worldview argument, but even setting that aside for a moment and saying, you know what, you don't even have to believe in Genesis. There's still the correct policy argument, because policy, if it's based on biblical truth, will still be the correct policy regardless of whether people buy into the biblical reason or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very well put, Jenna. And I think this is what intrigues me about him. I'll be honest. One of the reasons I didn't pay much attention to him, even when he became the House Speaker, wasn't anything personal. It's just that, you know, I didn't think he was going to last. You know, he's got like a 3-vote margin. Maybe he had a couple more even at the time. And now it's a tough thing. And he's got people, he's got rebels in the camp, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and there's others who want to oust him, who, you know, constantly threatening him. The fact that he has held this conference, this House Republican conference, together to get extraordinary things done. I mean, like, he, President Trump's agenda is getting done legislatively because Speaker Johnson is able to keep the House together. The Senate, the rules are different. If you have a majority, as long as you can work around the filibuster, which is its own challenge, but you have a little bit more discipline. The House requires, in this case, a strong Southern gentleman. He listens, he may disagree with you, but he brings consensus and he's getting stuff done.
Amazing. Well, Joel Rosenberg, as always, thanks so much, and we'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, amidst President Trump's focus and emphasis on artificial intelligence and getting good regulation and having the United States on the fore of this technology, a couple of headlines that we definitely want to cover, because the rise of AI and how it's being implemented across the world is very concerning. It's very fascinating, but we do definitely need to talk about it. And so this is coming from Right Angle News Network. Breaking: Delta Airlines will soon implement AI algorithms and dynamic pricing to scrape personal data, including emails, to determine the highest price you will pay for tickets, such as during a family funeral or other urgent trips, and will raise fares accordingly. This is receiving a lot of concern and backlash. And meanwhile, there is also a headline from CNBC and their tech portion of their news that Amazon is going to buy the AI company Bee that makes a wearable listening device. So Amazon has confirmed it plans to acquire Bee, a startup that makes a $50 artificial intelligence infused wearable. So basically, it almost looks like a Fitbit or a watch that you can wear that will record and summarize conversations, do a lot of different technology, perhaps even interpret languages. And so rather than speaking into Google Voice, for example, and having Google Translate, some of this stuff can be done right from a watch. So where are we going with artificial intelligence, and are all of these things the future, and should we be concerned? Well, let's welcome in Daniel Cochran, who is the Senior Research Associate for the Center of Technology and the Human Person. Daniel, let's start with Delta. You know, this seems really unethical to me, quite frankly, that, you know, in the midst of someone who maybe can afford a higher price ticket, or they have an urgent family need to travel, that Delta is using AI to target individuals to say, well, you know, you're going to have a higher price point than just the average ticket sale.
Jenna, it's great to be with you. And I think that this does raise a variety of concerns. And, you know, you mentioned in sort of the lead up to the headline, all of the personal information that will potentially be fed into the AI sort of determination of price. And one of the, you know, one of the bedrocks of our country in, you know, recent decades is laws that protect against discrimination based on, you know, race, religion, et cetera. And so, for instance, you know, you can't charge someone a different price, you know, for, say, an apartment or a service based on the color of their skin or what they believe. But with these sort of AI pricing, this new AI pricing model, that's really called into question, because it's really, really difficult to know on what basis the algorithm is you know, charging you what it's charging you, especially because it's all individualized. You know, one of the reasons I think that Delta is implementing this price system is because it's going to be able to harvest all of this information, knowing if you're, you know, going to Granny's funeral, as an example, it will be able to predict the kinds of prices that each individual customer might be willing to pay. So whereas before, you know, your fares on airlines were, you know, it based on what kind of, you know, amenities you receive, you know, with the how nice your seat is, you know, are you receiving extra services, et cetera. Now it'll be individual to you. So the company knows, oh, you're going on this really expensive vacation to Hawaii, say, and we know we can estimate your income. You have a really high income, but you're underpaying essentially for the ticket price. Well, let's charge you a higher price. Or, you know, let's say that, and this is, I think, even more concerning, this is like the Black Mirror scenario. Eventually, it's like, oh, you're someone who has engaged in, say, you posted something controversial online, and you pose a higher risk to the airline. So to account for that higher risk, we're gonna charge you a higher price. Or take another scenario. We're already seeing this and how some of the airlines have priced their fares. We think that you know, using fossil fuels for flying is, you know, a harm to the environment. So to kind of equalize the harms, we'll adapt the price to each individual based on what we think their income bracket are. So there's just a whole variety of possibilities for how this thing could go wrong. And I think that the bottom line is, like, how is this beneficial to the consumer? And I can imagine that Delta might come back and say, well, it's better for the consumer because by individualizing pricing, you know, it's possible that you could actually be charged less for a fare that you'd be charged, you normally be charged more for, right? That the insurance industry makes a similar claim. So the insurance industry for years have been using what's called telemedics. And essentially what that means is you agree to kind of constant monitoring of your activity or behavior. So say you're getting like driver's insurance, for instance, you accept like constant monitoring of your driving behavior. And in exchange, the insurance company agrees to price your monthly premium based on that behavior. So their promise is, well, you could pay less, but it comes at the expense of your privacy. So I think in both cases, like, even if it might create some short-term economic benefits for consumers, the privacy concerns and the concerns over how does this, like, you know, as it's integrated across our society, which I think it will be, what does that mean for just our basic liberties and well-being? And again, I think that's, you know, that raises some really, really concerning questions for the future.
Yeah, and I really love how you framed all of that, Daniel, because this does implicate more than just, well, you might be charged a little bit more, and is that really a harm on society? I mean, this really gets into fundamental questions of ethical concerns, right to privacy things, liberty concerns, and ultimately a social credit score, perhaps. I mean, because as you're mentioning, if the algorithm can tell and track how to fluctuate prices based on individual consumption, will it be, well, you know, we think that you've flown too much in the last year, and so we're going to charge you to offset that and for some kind of, you know, carbon credit or whatever, based on your consumerism and, you know, things like that, that aren't necessarily signaled to the consumer that's the rationale, but it could be very easily implemented on the back end. And so when we have these types of tools, do you foresee litigation over this, regulation first and foremost over this, or where should this conversation be headed to protect not just the companies who want to make more money, because if this wasn't profitable, I don't think Delta would be implementing it. Where does this go to protect our liberties?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to address the social credit score angle you brought up, because I think that's actually a real risk. And it's a real risk not just because of this individual, this specific system, but we see a lot of other systems coming online that, if integrated together, could lead to something like a social credit score. So as an example, there's been a huge movement around the world towards what's called a digital ID. And the idea behind a digital ID is it will be this kind of centralized, one-stop holder for all of your personally identifiable information, and it will, the argument is, it will be, you know, make markets so much more, and public services so much more efficient, because you'll have this single ID, and then it will give you, you know, confer access to all these things. Well, we kind of saw something similar around COVID, right? You heard talk and in some cases implementation of the COVID passport, but think about that now for everything and everyone. And you see companies already kind of starting to do something like this. Take WorldCoin, for instance, which is partially backed by Sam Altman. WorldCoin, actually, their goal is to create a comprehensive database of biometrics, including retinal scans of everyone in the world. So within the next, as I believe, 2 years, they're planning to roll out a program where they'll have, like, stands in, like, the mall, the gas station, where, you know, you can, you know, in exchange for a small Bitcoin or crypto payment, you actually get your retinal scan and put into this database. And their goal is they want to facilitate this, you know, digital ID. Now, what happens when you pair a digital ID with, like, all these other AI systems that are determining prices, access to service, et cetera? Well, it looks a whole lot like a social credit system, because ultimately what that means is these systems are going to be able to track you around society, around the world, every website that you visit, every social media post you put online, and all of that could potentially feed into how your services are priced and what you get access to, what you don't. So I think it's a really, I think that is one version of the future that's really concerning. But I think what's important for your listeners to know is it doesn't have to be that way. And I think one of the ways that we can prevent that sort of future is pushing for open source and decentralized AI technology. So let's think about what that would mean in at least two ways. First, think about how we train AI models and how AI models access information for inferencing. So inferencing is like you give ChatGPT a task and it goes and does the task, okay? That's what's going on behind the scenes for it to produce the output. So right now, everything you're putting into the chat box with GPT or another model, it's owned, it's controlled by the model and the company. But imagine a future where the model, like the algorithm, comes to your data rather than your data going to the algorithm. And I was here, I believe, a month or so ago talking a little bit about blockchain and the possibilities that blockchain unlocks. That's one of them. Like, blockchain technology through zero-knowledge proofs can actually allow for privacy-enhancing methods
for information exchange, where you keep your core information so that the companies don't get it, but the algorithm to process specific requests that you put to it can access enough information to know what it needs to do the task, but the company doesn't retain your information. So privacy-preserving methods of training and data access are really critical. The other thing I think is critical is a decentralized AI ecosystem, and there are several things to like think about there, but the biggest point is open source AI models, right? So open source means open source, open weight models. Truly open source, open weight means that you can know all of the parameters and all the data that's been used to create the parameters in the model. So ultimately, it might take resources and time and expertise, but you can actually adjust the model. So you can change you can identify biases it has. You can change those biases. You can change how the model is tuned. Right. So what specific use cases it's better or worse at. You can change its performance on various benchmarks. And allowing there to be like kind of let a thousand flowers bloom in some sense, rather than keeping AI the province of a handful of massive corporations, I think is really essential to pushing back on this dystopian future where everything is sort of mediated by three companies and it's just like their AI is determining what we get charged and what we have access to. So there's just a couple ideas for your listeners in terms of how I think we combat this.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Daniel Cochran, who is the Senior Research Associate for the Center for Technology and the Human Person. And you mentioned open AI and inputting the data, but the company not actually retaining that data in order to provide what the algorithm needs in order to generate the response. And for those of us who use ChatGPT and some of these others, Sam Altman was just recorded, I think, last week talking about how the conversations and the chats on ChatGPT are not actually private, and they can be subpoenaed for litigation purposes. Have you searched some of these things in potentially domestic relations issues, other types of civil or even criminal litigation? And that's really concerning in terms of a right to privacy, because I think people assume that their searches and other information in terms of data privacy is protected. And so President Trump, for a long time on the campaign trail, has been talking about data privacy and the digital Bill of Rights. So where is the Trump administration at with this and Congress overall? Because if they're falling behind on this, then this is such, I just see this being a really big concern overall for erosion of constitutional protections as we've known them since the founding of America and now.
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of those concerns are valid. And to double click on the Sam Altman point, so Sam Altman, in response to that concern, he's like, well, I know the answer. What we should do is essentially grant legal privilege, the kind of legal privilege, let's say, you would have with a doctor or a lawyer for your conversations with ChatGPT. But notice what that sort of solution would do. It wouldn't change the power dynamics of what AI companies can access or retain about you. That just entrenches the ability of OpenAI to retain all of that information without having to answer to the government. Now, I certainly think it's a huge problem that the government can potentially access all of the information, all of the chats, or other private companies for that matter, can access all the information, all the chats we put into these systems. But I think, again, the solution needs to be allowing users, allowing the normal Americans who are interfacing with these services to have sovereignty over their data and over where their data is going and what it's used for. And to your question, your second point, which is, well, what's Congress doing? Well, Congress has repeatedly failed, despite talking over and over for years about the need for comprehensive data privacy. Congress has repeatedly failed to deliver. Take the American Privacy Rights Act, a piece of legislation near and dear to my heart. I was involved in that last year. I mean, Congress essentially, it was stopped in Congress largely because of big tech lobbyists. And that's unfortunately where a lot of these bills go, is that, the tech industry gets into the ears of leadership, into the ears of members, and they're able to stop it in its tracks. And of course, who suffers? It's not the industry, it's the normal Americans. And that's who's really going to bear all the casualties of this AI stuff if we don't we don't get a handle on it very quickly.
Yeah. Well, Daniel Cochran, really appreciate your insights as always. This is so fascinating to me, and I think this really should be a bigger priority if we're going to keep constitutional protection. So definitely want to have you on again soon to continue the conversation. Thanks so much. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.